From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, our Week in Review assesses the political turmoil on Beacon Hill and former Senate President Stan Rosenberg's fall from political grace.
We are now at the point where we need a president who has the full responsibilities and the full authority of a president of the Senate.
Also, fallout from New Hampshire's rejection of Northern Pass and what the State Gaming Commission wants to know following the resignation of Steve Wynn.
A central question is, what did the board of directors and staff know, and when did they know it?
It's all part of our Week in Review. Also today, the Olympic Games begin in Pyeongchang, South Korea. And...
hey, ready. I see you shining. You see me shining.
Hype Man, a new play about hip-hop and a police shooting that explores questions of race, justice, and identity. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. They trying to stop me, but
it's my time. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our Week in Review, beginning with the leadership turmoil on Beacon Hill. This week, state senators voted to install Harriet Chandler as Senate president for the rest of the legislative session, which ends any question that the embattled former president Stan Rosenberg would return. Here's Chandler on Wednesday.
We are now at the point where we need a president who has the full responsibilities and the full authority of a president of the Senate.
The former Senate president, Stan Rosenberg, was forced to step down temporarily following allegations last December that his husband, Brian Hefner, sexually harassed at least four men. Sunday, the Boston Globe reported that Rosenberg had given Hefner access to his email and Senate calendar, which, if true, represents a major breach in Rosenberg's promised firewall between his personal and professional lives. And so Rosenberg's presidency is over, though he still serves in the chamber. Governor Charlie Baker says the Senate's investigation needs to run its course.
The allegations are troubling, deeply concerning, and I think it's incumbent on the committee that's been assigned the job of investigating this to get to the bottom of these right away.
So that's where we'll begin today. What's next for the state Senate and sexual harassment on Beacon Hill? And joining us now in the studio is Richard Tessay. He's a former Republican leader in the Massachusetts State Senator. Richard, happy Friday. Great to have you.
Happy Friday.
Also with us is the Reverend Mariama White Hammond, a minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, activist and organizer. Mariama, great to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So I'll start with you, Richard. I know that you spent a lot of years serving with Stan Rosenberg. What do you think of where we are right now on Beacon Hill?
It's pretty much unprecedented, given the events that have occurred, obviously, and the transition that's happened in the state Senate. The office of the Senate president is one of the most important in state government, and I always tell people that state government as a whole is sort of like a three-legged stool. You have the speaker, they call them the big three, the speaker, the governor, and the Senate president. And you don't have that right now. Harriet, as the new Senate president, isn't going to have the same type of authority as somebody who isn't a lame duck, who everybody knows, is going to be back the next session. So what's transpired, I think, has really been, a lot of the members are having, it's very difficult to deal with, obviously. And, again, unprecedented, uncharted waters.
Yeah. Mariama, I mean, what do you think of make of the decision to push Rosenberg out before the investigation is complete?
Well, I, as a person, I do marriage counseling. I know it's complicated that we can't always be held responsible for where our spouse is, and we may not always be as honest with ourselves about what that person is doing. So I wanted to reserve judgment, but it sort of feels like each new piece that comes out is more and more concerning. I could see why you might share calendars. My husband and I share calendars, and he's a government official, and I got to figure out if we can make it to dinner and things like that. But why you would have access to their email? It's just sort of increasingly looking. Like the the Senate president's eyes kind of weren't on the ball in terms of making sure that there's an appropriate boundary between the work he was doing in the Senate and what his husband was
doing. And especially given that promise to have that firewall separating his personal from his professional life, right?
Right. You know, I mean, and again, it's tough. Like, yeah. My husband works in education. People call me. I have nothing to say on education. You know, so it's you've got to have think through how you make sure that the person who is responsible to the people is not confused with a spouse who hasn't had that same level of responsibility and transparency. And unfortunately, I hope they continue the investigation. But it was so much has been coming out that I do think his ability to do his job was pretty compromised
right.
by where things are now.
And they had definitely got to the point where even if somehow he had been cleared
yeah.
from the investigation, if that ends up happening, his effectiveness as the Senate president and ability to lead the chamber is compromised by all of this. So obviously it's I think the Senate did the right thing.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of where this political story goes here in terms of elections. So here's Democratic State Senator Barbara Leetalien, who says all of this turmoil should worry Democrats in November.
I think they all need to be concerned. Everyone's going to be on the ballot in September or November, and I think they all need to be concerned about this. And that's why I think we need to focus on the institution.
So what do you think? Richard, I'll start with you with that. Respond to that idea. Will there be sort of a political reckoning on Beacon Hill over this?
We'll see what the voters end up doing. I think, a lot depends upon what happens for the rest of the session, and if the legislature... You know, they have a lot on their plate right now and probably haven't had the most productive session so far. So if they can do some things before the end of the year, obviously, I don't know. Everybody knows their own individual senator and usually likes them. And I think, the races are local, but you never know what's going to end up happening. So, yeah, it's a bit of a concern. But again, I think most of the senators have their own profile. And,
yeah.
And do their own thing.
What do you think, Mariam? I mean, I'm just wondering, I'm thinking of the word sort of, Richard used the word a moment ago, political vacuum sort mm-hmm. of momentarily up there in the Senate, maybe longer than momentary.
I'm less concerned about Republicans or Democrats who should be worried. I think there's a general concern about integrity of our mm-hmm. leaders and our institutions. And that could mean that anyone who's associated with that sort of lack of integrity and transparency could be in trouble. And I think the opportunity really is moving beyond party for folks to ask some tough questions about what do we want from our elected officials? What kind of integrity do we hope for them? I was a little frustrated when you saw, us cutting budgets but giving them raises. That was the kind of thing that, for me was kind of it just felt like a bad constellation of events at the same time. So, for me, beyond parties, I do think this is a moment when folks are asking some tough questions about what we expect. And so I think all leaders should be doing, maybe a little personal inventory. And we'll see what happens if this comes out in the elections. But I would have a guess, given Me Too and all sorts of other things, that people are going to be asking some tough questions.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about an issue that, there's definitely some issues in common here. Allegations of sexual misconduct against the casino mogul Steve Wynn, who stepped down this week as CEO of Wynn Resorts, which is currently building, of course, a multi-billion-dollar hotel and casino palace in Everett. Wynn's resignation was sparked by a Wall Street Journal story last month alleging a decades-long pattern of sexual misconduct, including a $7.5 million settlement paid to a former Las Vegas casino employee who he allegedly forced into sex. The Massachusetts Gaming Commission is now investigating the matter, and the fundamental question really is, will Wynn Resorts retain the license for that Everett casino? So here's Stephen Crosby, chairman of the State Gaming Commission, who said this week among the questions he wants answered, did other people in Wynn Resorts, beyond Steve Wynn, who qualified for the license, know about the allegations against Wynn?
The question, a central question, is what did the board of directors and staff know, and when did they know it about the settlement and the associated allegations? That's a critical point for us and for the public of Massachusetts to know ASAP.
So, Mariama, where does this leave this whole situation, you know, the Everett Casino, which still bears Wynn's name.
Yeah. So for me, I've sat on a number of boards. If they knew, it's a problem. If they didn't know, that's also a problem. Mm. What kind of organization are you running when you're making multi-million dollar payouts and your board has no idea? It would seem to me that just to have insurance, which is probably how they did some level of payout, somebody had to sign off on this. So either we have a question of bad governance or sort of, again, not being fully transparent. So for me, there are questions on either side of things. And the question is, you know, we've got this building that's, you know, not done, but it's certainly progressed pretty substantially.
It's rising high in the sky above the Mystic River. It's come out of the ground in a big way. Yeah.
What happens if they lose the license? But for me, either way, the board is not off the hook for me.
Yeah. What do you think, Steve?
This is the largest single phase development history in Massachusetts history. $2.4 billion halfway through. So I think you got to think long and hard about pulling the rug out at this point. As far as governance, you know, goes, from what I understand, the payment was a private payment. It didn't have anything to do with this company. And therefore, when they did the application, you know, it was obviously, they didn't ask that on the application. They were looking for criminal or ties to organized crime. So, you know, I think it's important that he left the company. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, as Steve Crosby said, to look and see if there's anybody in the company that knew about this. But I think at this point, you know, for all practical purposes, clean up the problem there, but continue on ahead. And I think that that's what's going to end up happening.
So here's former Everett City Councilor Michael Mangan, who told WBZ Channel 4 that he has worries about the project's positive impacts on Everett. I mean, how they could all be affected by all of this.
Having two daughters of my own, I certainly don't condone anyone with sexual harassment. It's not, should never be tolerated. I'm certainly interested in what the commission has to say. And I just hope, honestly, going forward, that the commission doesn't punish the project.
So they're hopeful that he's hoping that the commission doesn't punish the project. Mariam, I guess what he's referring to is that the license isn't pulled, essentially. I mean, do you think there's really a risk that this casino might not get built, that it might not open?
Well, you know, I mean, it's, to be honest with you, I was ambivalent about the casino to begin with. I have to be honest about some of the assessments of benefit. I have always felt a little unclear and unsubstantiated to me. But I think in the long run, I also think we have to acknowledge that 5 years ago, being a rampant sexual harasser and even a rapist didn't deter most people from doing everything that they were doing. And there has been a sea change, and I hope it's a sea change that continues. But I do also think there's a reality that we will continue to uncover that people were getting away with a lot of things for a long time. So I do think that that is a bit of a challenge, you know, and we'll have to think through and figure out how we move forward. I do think we have to, you know, sort of evaluate where this goes. And if Wynn doesn't get it, is there someone else that could, you know, so there, I think there are deeper questions to ask. I'm not, if you want me to predict, I don't know where to stand on what will happen.
And the Wall Street Journal article was horrendous.
And yeah,
there
really was
no way that he could continue on and operate the casino at this point. So the fact that he stepped aside is really important. You know, again, they have to look at the top leadership there and make sure that they weren't a part of or covering up anything that took place. But, you know, we've already debated that. I'm not a big casino guy, but the legislature had the debate. The public had the debate as far as the pros and cons of a casino. That's not really what this is about. Again, I think it's a good point that you have people saying, hey, there's been this huge investment. They're halfway through. There's $1 billion to go. You know, you're not going to.
On the other hand, you've got people like Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone, who, of course, long opposed the casino. But he tweeted this week, if the state revokes the license, no reason the site still has to house a casino. Lots of things could go there. Mass has a housing crisis, not a casino crisis.
So is the mayor going to take it by eminent domain, or is he going to pay for the extra $1.5 billion to finish the project? Is he just going to seize it? I mean, it doesn't, you know, you can posture, I guess, on this. And the casino probably would have been built already had it not been for lawsuits that the mayor filed. So, you know, I don't think that that's a practical thing. At the end of the day, they're going to finish that casino.
Okay, very quickly, I want to just hear from Governor Baker on this. He told reporters at the State House that he wants the Gaming Commission's investigation to move quickly to resolve this. Here it is.
I think it's incumbent on them to move quickly on this and to do as thorough an investigation in a short period of time as they can. Because, as many have said, including me, the allegations are appalling, and if deemed to be legit, would not meet the suitability test in the Massachusetts law.
So earlier this week, I know the State Gaming Commission talked about the sort of pressure to get this done quickly. On the other hand, they said to do a thoughtful investigation based on fact is going to take some time. So I'm not sure how quickly this is going to get done. Anyway, let's move on, because there's one more subject I want to talk about, and one more political story with region-wide implications that we talked about this past week. After New Hampshire denied the Northern Pass hydropower project a key permit, the Baker administration chose the $1.6 billion plan to bring Canadian hydropower into Massachusetts through New Hampshire. This week, Attorney General Maura Healey demanded more transparency in the process amidst questions around fairness, because the region's three main utilities, Eversource, National Grid, and Unitil, helped judge the bids and then selected the Northern Pass, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eversource. I mean, it's a little, so there's a lot going on here. But Richard, let me start with you on this. What's your take on what's going on?
A big mistake to, you know, there were 45 bidders. And the reason why that bid, the Northern Pass project, from what I understand, was so advantageous is because, the promise was it would be able to come online within a couple of years. It was quickness. It throws the whole process into turmoil. And I would just say that this is a new process that was being undertaken. It's a little disingenuous for Maura Healey to be shocked, because she's been following the process all along. The legislature passed a bill last year that set up this whole procurement process, not only for wind, not only for hydro, but there's also a similar process going on right now for wind. And the bottom line is the region needs energy, and if the Northern Pass is dead, we've wasted a lot of time, because I think what's going to end up happening is everybody's going to have to go back to the drawing board. They're going to have to find another bidder, and there are a lot of people who felt very uncomfortable from the beginning, given the mechanics of the way things, bidders having interest in the the projects and so forth.
I mean, I think, unfortunately, there were people that raised concerns about how this process was before, myself being among them. Why are the utilities so? I know they need to be at the table, but you set up a conflict of interest, and then are surprised when people say, "Hey, we're not so sure about this because there's a conflict of interest." There's a couple of things I think. I've got an opportunity to meet with some of the tribes that are directly affected by this, the First Nations tribes in Canada, who are pretty adamantly against this. Lots of those issues have not been addressed. And I actually have two feelings about transmission lines. I mean, on one hand, I understand they do. They create some level of disruption in communities. On the other hand, I do think we do need some level of transmission lines, because there's never going to be, for instance, in Boston, enough, wind power or solar power to power that city. So we're going to always have to have some level of transmission lines. I think the problem is the way the process has been done, and the people who are at the forefront of the process have very little public trust. Sending Eversource to a community to talk about transmission lines, probably not going to get the same level of support. So as a person who cares a lot about the environment and climate justice, I think we do need to have this conversation. I think some people raised these concerns a year and a half ago. I didn't feel that the governor's office was so interested in hearing them. So I'm not altogether surprised, although, I thought they were going to just find a way to ram it through. That's how they do with all the pipelines and other things. They've been able to sort of just push it through.
Again, though, the legislation was set up to give the attorney general a role. There's an independent evaluator who's supposed to look at all the contracts. So, and there were, again, 46 bids. So, I think the big problem here, which is so stunning, is that they had all these bids and ended up going with this particular one with the expectation that everything was set on New Hampshire's end. And, you know, and when the site...
But it's not even all set on Canada's end.
The site selection committee, you know, from what I understand from people in New Hampshire, everybody knew that the committee up in New Hampshire was going to vote against it. It ended up being 7-0. So the intelligent, I mean, to go with that one, to put all your eggs in that basket, obviously was a mistake. And
it seems like they could have, should have seen this coming before or this far down the track. Right. But here we are. It'll be interesting to watch how it shakes out. Richard Tesei, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, thanks for coming in.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Have a great weekend. And Reverend Mariama White Hammond, minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, thank you as well. Have a great weekend.
Great to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Music from the opening ceremonies early this morning of the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. The themes of the ceremony were harmony, convergence, passion, and peace. It included 20,000 fireworks, a huge circle of drummers, and more than 1,000 South Koreans carrying candles to form a dove of peace. Tara Sullivan, sports columnist for the Boston Globe, it was at the opening ceremonies and joins us now from South Korea. Hi, Tara. Good to have you.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. It sounded like quite a ceremony. Give me your impressions of what it was like to be there. What did you see?
It was quite a ceremony. It's just such pageantry, you know, in the best possible way. It's my first Olympics, so watching it... I thought it was great. I thought the emphasis on peace and peace in the world and given the backdrop between South Korea and North Korea and the fact that they marched under one flag, you know, you just felt kind of the best of the Olympic ideal and the best of what sports can be, even if it's only for a short window. I felt that was really, it was a very tasteful ceremony. They saved kind of all the pyrotechnics toward the end, really built up to a great crescendo.
So you mentioned North Korean and South Korean athletes walking together under one flag, a unified Korean flag. How did the crowd react to that? That must have been quite an emotional moment.
It was. And you know, that to me is the absolute beauty of the event, is as those athletes start to march in, because you can just hear the different pockets of fans through, you know, people in the stands as they're coming in, and you watch the athletes themselves, and some are crying and some are dancing and some are laughing, and they're all, you know, you can almost feel what they're feeling in that moment. And then when that that last nation came in and it was the two Koreas together, it was almost like a hush of anticipation and then really wild applause for the people, for the home fans. Really, really moving moment when they came in.
So I understand that Kim Yo-jong, that's the sister of North Korean leader Kim mm-hmm. Jong-un, was seated near Vice President Mike Pence and the South Korean President Moon Jae-in. So I'm wondering what happened. Did they acknowledge each other?
They did. They didn't show us, it's funny, even within the stands, they didn't show us our Vice President as much, but they did show greetings between the two leaders, well, the sister and the Korean leader. And, you know, again, that just hasn't happened. I mean, these are nations that are so fractured and have had, you know, I mean, we're talking about nuclear threats and things. And so to see even a moment of conciliation, I think nobody really knew if or how that would happen during these Olympics. And to see a handshake and to see some smiles and, you know, things like that was really just amazing.
Yeah. Well, let the games begin. I'm wondering, Tara, what are you most looking forward to following?
Oh, what are we not, right? I mean, it's amazing. I'm interested in the hockey tournaments. I'm interested in the figure skating. Growing up for me, that was when I always really enjoyed watching. And again, like I said, it's the first time I've covered this event. So I'm looking forward to some of that. The ice hockey tonight, that unified Korean team will play its first game, so I know that will draw some attention and should be interesting. I'm interested in oh gosh, I could go on forever, curling and bobsledding and all those sports that we try to figure out, and then the downhill ski racing and you name it. We'll be out there from the Globe.
Well, Tara Sullivan is a sports columnist for the Boston Globe. She's been reporting for us from Pyeongchang, South Korea, talking about the opening ceremonies and, of course, the start of the 2018 Winter Olympics. Tara, have fun out there, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And you can find a link to Tara's coverage of the Olympics at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, a new play explores different reactions to police violence and complicated questions about race and racial identity. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. I came up dirty, they didn't want me to shine. No pot to sip in, they don't want me to shine. This is the song The Boy Shining, music from a new play now on stage at Company One Theater in Boston. It tells a story that could be pulled right out of today's headlines about a multiracial rap group that's about to make it big when it lands its first performance on The Tonight Show. Then comes news of an unarmed black teenager shot dead by a white cop. And the reactions from the three members of the group, one black, one white, one multiracial, strain their friendships as they grapple with the questions of race, justice, and identity. The play is called Hype Man, a breakbeat play, and it's written by Idris Goodwin, who joins me in the studio right now. Idris, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Sean LeCount. He's the artistic director and founding member of Company One Theater, which is dedicating its 19th season to the works and voices of living black male playwrights. Sean, great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So, Idris, let me get you to set up the story a little mm-hmm. more. So, after the shooting, two of the characters, I understand, Verb, who is black, and Pinnacle, who is white, have very different reactions about whether or not and how to acknowledge this shooting in their music, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so they're sort of at this, they've been friends their whole life and sort of fell into hip-hop and fell in love with the music and started making independent music and sort of worked their way up the ranks together as friends. And now they're at a moment where things are changing for them. It's starting to become more of a business. And they now have this opportunity to go on The Tonight Show and do this song called The Boy Shining with this incredible production made by their brand new beat maker, who is this female character named Peep One. On the eve of this event, they get the news of this unarmed 17-year-old kid who gets shot by the police 18 times. Mm. And so Verb's immediate reaction is he immediately is like, you know, he himself is coming out of this transitional period of getting his life together, and he's reflecting. He's saying, I could have been this kid. This isn't right. I'm finally in a place where I feel like I want to do something. We have the Tonight Show Forum. The universe put this in our lives right now at this moment. We got to seize it. We got to say something. Mm. And Pinnacle is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We just got here. Like, we've worked so hard to get here. Let's not even get into that. Let's just, you know, we're going to indirectly right. say something.
Let's establish ourselves as artists.
Yes.
Let's do this and let's not rock the boat too
exactly.
much.
Okay. Exactly. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so from then on, the play, they begin to sort of wrestle as a trio around, well, what are your obligations and do you owe it? Do you mm-hmm. owe it to the community to speak up? Because hip hop is a business and it is popular music, but it's also has community roots. It's still a grassroots, still has grassroots connections. And so it's really a play about those questions. Like, does hip hop still have that responsibility or is it purely just, you know, pop and entertainment?
I'm also interested and I should say it. I told you before we went on the air, I haven't seen this play yet. I'm mm-hmm. very interested to
Sean
to,
and I
to,
can do it for you right quick. Come on, let's go, Sean. 30-second version. Let's go.
No, but the question is one of sort of, you know, here's a black guy and a white guy. They're working together. They're co-artists, so they're close in all kinds of ways. But the fact that they have this fundamental difference in sort of how to react to this event. I mean, what does it say about questions of, compassion, of, you know, to what extent white folks can sort of get in the shoes of black folks or vice versa.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, so there's a lot of levels to it, right? Because on one hand, you know, in this dynamic, you have Pinnacle, who's the, you know, the lead frontman rapper. And then you have Verb, who is the hype man, who is there to support and excite, and you know what I mean. And there's a tradition of that relationship, and so but what you have is you have someone who's the primary voice, and then you have someone who's the supportive voice. And in this situation, you have the supportive African American voice saying, no, like you need to, you're the guy in front, and we gave you the power to have the mic and to do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Now this is what's required of you. And Pinnacle's like, no.
No. You know what I mean? This not today. Is my voice.
Yeah, exactly. Not today. It's yeah. it's it, and so that and I think that's, you know, a microcosm of what's happening across the spectrum. And I think this is a very interesting intersectional moment where, you know, immigrant folks are asking, you know, citizens to advocate for them. Women are asking men to advocate for them. I mean, we're in this moment where groups on the so-called margins are asking, you know, for allyship. In a very circuitous, interesting way that I've not seen before, and so that's kind of what the play is looking at. It's like, you know, how do we support one another, and when is it incumbent on us to support one another?
It sounds really fabulous. Sean LeCount, artistic director and founding member of Company One Theater. So, the theater is dedicating this 19th season to the works and voices of living black male playwrights. What did you like about including this play, Idris's play, in this body of work?
Yeah, so we have a relationship as a company with Idris from when we did his play How He Got On, which was an early play in his breakbeat play cycle. I get that right? Breakbeat play cycle. And it was great. It was a very successful piece. Summer L. Williams directed it beautifully. And we fell in love with the work, but also with Idris's voice. I think that it's rare to find a playwright whose mission seems to align so well with ours. And we're certainly a mission-focused organization. See ourselves at the intersection of social justice and art.
Well, I want to play a little more music from this play. So this is Justice for Gerard, which is, and Idris, correct me if I'm not setting this up correctly. I understand it's the sort of the result of a collaboration between Verb, the black guy, and Peep One, the biracial woman in the group, right?
Yeah, they did the, you know, Pinnacle has decided I'm not going to be part of any protest music. And so Verb and Peep One collaborate, but then they bring in this other rapper who earlier in the play we learned there's a story they tell about this rapper battling Pinnacle in the studio, you know, and then so there's a little bit of, you know, there's an extra sting to it because they got one of his enemies.
And so Justice for Gerard, and he's the 17-year-old who was shot dead. Okay, let's listen to a little bit of this.
Yeah. Look, 18 shots, 17, hit the same soul, but the cops got acquitted, joy boy, same old rap for us colored folks, so we can't have peace, you can hold your truth, try and lock us up when it's time we get loose, always on trial like we're meant to lose, and the sun goes down but we never snooze, at all, the block is hot, legit, the stops, the itch, I'm
a zip, my response to the conqueror was hard. He just likes it too, he's shaking and
I can't stop.
You can't stop myself. So tell me about the sort of role of hip-hop here. I mean, it's often been used as a form of resistance. Not always, but but often, and certainly in this play it is. So tell me how you were thinking about it.
Oh, man. I'm going to try to keep this semi-brief. So as Sean mentioned, this is the third play in a series of what I call breakbeat plays, which are plays that sort of explore the intersection of like hip-hop in terms of its creation, its history, its aesthetics, and its social contributions, and also like personal relationships, right? And so, but this is the first in the series that's set present day, and I would say it's the most overtly political. So, if there was a rap group equivalent, you know, How We Got On was Kid and Play, the Realness was maybe the Fugees, and then this one is definitely Public Enemy. You know what I mean? And so it's really sort of got an edge to it in that way. But you know, hip hop's roots has interesting roots. It was always party music, but it was party music created to calm and soothe like tensions in the South Bronx. You know, it was very strategically used to get the gangs to stop fighting for a moment. You know what I mean? And to really just get people to celebrate their youth. But that connection to street organizations and to the real problems of the area that it came out of were always there. And so I think that's still happening today. It's still the one vehicle where, you know, marginalized people especially can really like affect culture. I mean, look at, you know, Kendrick Lamar's album Damn, you know, almost won album of the year. And really, according, you know, for most people, was the real album of the year. You know what I mean? And that is a very, very, you know, overtly political record, as was his last one. And so, you know, we see Beyonce at the Super Bowl and like, you know, wearing like Black Panther garb, like, you know, all these things are little nods and tips of the hat to, you know, hip hop, but even more so, you know, hip hop's connection to the you know, the Black experience, the Black narrative in America that goes all the way back to slavery to now.
And what about the sort of question of the role of white artists who participate in hip hop and hip hop culture? I mean, this obviously comes into the play as well.
Well, one of the great things about working with Company One is Company One is got a wonderful team, from scenic to directing, production, acting, everything. But also we have a wonderful dramaturg named Jesse Baxter who worked on the show. And if you come to the show, there's all this wonderful information in the program that traces the history, the timeline of white involvement in Black music, but particularly in hip hop. And so what we see, I mean, going back to jazz, blues, all of it, there's always been white folks in the mix, you know, as artists, as executives, as producers, and there's plenty of great case studies of that allyship working out in really positive ways. But there's certainly plenty of examples of the public and the machine exalting certain artists purely because they know they're going to be palatable to a largely white audience. You know, Elvis Presley, Pat Boone used to sing like Black records that like the radio couldn't play. You know what I mean? Because they were R&B records, which was code for Black music, you know? And so they got like white people to just sing those records, you know, with usually a lot less soul, no shots, but you know, check the tape. So it's no different, and it's no different with hip hop either. And so artists like, you know, Eminem and Macklemore and G-Eazy and all this, I mean, you know, they're certified to some degree. I mean, you know, they have Black fans, you know, certain, they've paid their dues. They've come up in those circles. But the issue is when they get sort of exalted over some of the other folks who are of equal or higher ability.
Well, Idris Goodwin, he wrote Hype Man, a breakbeat play, and Sean LeCount, the director of Hype Man, a breakbeat play. It's showing at the Company One Theater through February 24th. You can find a whole lot more information at our website, radioboston.org. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's great. Look forward to seeing it. That's it for today. Have a great weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.